first of all, for the just for the tape, tell us your name and who you are.
My name is Rafael Anchilla. I'm a school board member in DISD. I represent District 7, which roughly encompasses West Dallas, North Oak Cliff, Central Oak Cliff, and Arcadia Park. I'm also an attorney with the law firm of Patton Boggs, which is based out of Washington, D.C., and which has an 80-person branch office here in Dallas. I do finance work.
Hey, what got you interested in law?
It's an interesting story. I'm the son of immigrants. My father's from Spain. He himself has a seventh grade education, and his father's a sheep herder. He grew up during the fallout from the Spanish Civil War, which was 36 through 39. His family was on the losing side of the war, and it was a very difficult time for him. So he, in his mind, there were very few things that his son, his eldest son, were going to do, and they had to be reputable. So it was a small universe of being either a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer, or an architect. He really didn't have a big worldview of other things that were available. For some reason, law seemed very good. He was also inspired. It was in this country during the Watergate scandal. It was very inspired by the prosecuting counsel in Watergate, and some of his heroes were lawyers. Jerry Spence, whose books he had read many times, were some of his heroes, and inevitably that filtered down to his eldest son, me, and I began a path, even though it was probably unknowing when I was in high school, to become a lawyer. I was on the debate team. I was in student politics. I participated in the court observer program. I took whatever sort of pre-law offerings there were, and then when I went to college, it was just sort of a kind of done deal that when I was done with college, I was going to be a lawyer without really any self-study to examine whether or not that's what I wanted to do. But in retrospect, I'm happy I am a lawyer because I think it's been a wonderful education. It's been certainly an empowering experience for me.
Where did you go to college at?
A small liberal arts college in Dallas, Texas, called SMU. Yeah.
And where did you go to law school?
Law school was at Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Can you tell us a little bit about your family background?
Sure, and I've alluded to it a little bit. My father's always proud to say that in just two generations, the Anchillas have gone from sheep herders on the side of a mountain to lawyers, and he attributes that to the opportunity that we received in this country. My father emigrated to this country in the mid-50s from what was war-savage Spain, and he is Basque. For those of you who know anything about Spain, that's the Basques are a very proud and independent people in the northeast corner of Spain that fought up on the side of the democratically elected republic against the fascists and Franco. And the Basque region was severely persecuted subsequent to the Spanish Civil War. And it was a very difficult time for many Basques, and my father being one of them, with not a lot of education and very little opportunity, came to the United States to pursue a professional athletic career. He was a Hialeah player. For any of you who are familiar with Hialeah, or a pelotari, as they're called, much of the Basque diaspora from Spain occurred via athletics and via Hialeah, and their Hialeah in its heyday was played all over the world, and most predominantly in the United States here in Florida. So he ended up, without speaking the language, at 17 years old in a little country town called Ojas, Florida, during his rookie year at Dania Hialeah. And my mother, her path was a little bit different. Her parents also fought on the side of the Republic and were forced to be exiled. They were exiled to Mexico, and my mother was born and raised in Mexico City and Acapulco. Ironically, her father was also a Hialeah player, Justino Michelena, and he was also a well-known engraver. He was an artisan, and he engraved many of the handguns and rifles for many of the Mexican presidents, and was sort of developed a nice little cottage industry for himself. And then received a job offer to come to the United States to the Colt manufacturing plant in Attleboro, Massachusetts. And my mother at that time was 15 years old. So she came to the United States then and completed her high school at Miami High School in Miami, Florida. And I'm trying to get it as the chronology as best possible, but roughly that's what it's like. And then they had a long courtship and they got married in 1967 and I occurred in 1968. And then I was born and raised in Miami, attended public school in Miami, Florida, and came out to Dallas sight unseen in 1986 to accept the scholarship at SMU.
What was your scholarship for?
It was academic scholarship. It was called a university scholarship back then.
Growing up in Dade County, knowing it's governed by a conservative Cuban community,
mm-hmm.
How the policies there influenced you with your career with the DISD?
That's interesting. I don't know that they really have. In fact, my high school, Miami Coral Park High School, was probably when I was attending, it was about 90, probably 95% Latino, with about 60% of those students being Cuban. I was in the Young Democrats there, so I was a minority within a minority, and there were only about four of us in Young Democrats in the entire school. My graduating class was 615, just to give you an idea. So if anything, it probably made me more of a contrarian than anything else, living in Miami and never always appreciating my colleagues, my Cuban immigrant colleagues and friends, and also appreciating my friends from Nicaragua, El Salvador, Colombia, the Dominican. I mean, you got to understand that Miami is just more than sort of a Cuban enclave. It really is kind of an interesting melting pot. And I came away from Miami with two things, sort of a contrarian against a pretty conservative ideology and what I perceive to be an intolerant ideology by people who predominated. But secondly, I also had an interesting appreciation for a place that was pan-Latino, where you had a substantial diversity and you know, Latinos were neither good or bad. They were Latinos, and they were in power in many places. And I think I came to Dallas with that experience, which was an extremely different experience than what a lot of people who grew up in Dallas may have experienced. Because I witnessed Latinos in power who did wonderful things, and I witnessed Latinos in power who did terrible things. And people who were competent and kind, and people who were egotistical and destructive. So I think I come to the party with a little bit different experience because I was raised in Miami. But I don't want to say that I don't want to place a value judgment on it, just to suggest it's different.
Did you come to Dallas when you were entering college? Did you have aspirations of a political career, or what more inspired you to a leadership position?
That's interesting. You know, I never ran for anything in college, including in my fraternity. I never ran for office. I was, my parents were struggling so much, and SMU was such a culture shock when I got there. The level of wealth and the homogeneity of that school was a little bit overwhelming for me, and so I struggled. I needed to figure out what it was all about before I thought I could be empowered to do anything politically, and it took me a while. And then the second part of the equation was I knew how much my parents were struggling to help get me in school, and I had scholarships and everything like that, but they certainly weren't full scholarships. My parents, you know, did what they could to send me $100 a month, and that was in part for the phone bill so I could call home. It was before the advent of cellular phones and the internet, really, so it goes back a little ways. And long distance was expensive, and things were really, really tight. I remember I didn't even have a winter coat my first summer. I didn't have sweaters my first winter at SMU. And so my focus wasn't politics. It wasn't doing anything like that. It was really just surviving, understanding what Dallas and SMU were about, and doing well in my studies. And I threw myself into my studies. I triple majored in Spanish, Latin American studies, and anthropology, and graduated with honors. That was really my focus. It was nothing political.
Okay, last question. Coming from a place where there are so many Latin or Latino leaders, then coming to Dallas and actually being, like, for example, a member of the DIC school board member, mm-hmm. how is that different?
Well, I'll tell you, it was, I remember one of my initial reactions when I stepped on campus. My mom came with me during the summer orientation that we had, and I was struck and turned to my mom and I said, "Mommy, aquí los Latinos están pisados." It means that the Latinos are stepped on. Because the only Latinos I saw were picking up trash, doing janitorial work, and they weren't my professors, they weren't my classmates. And I'll never forget that reaction that I had. It was kind of a shock. And over time, you know, as you're working to kind of build your career and sort of establish oneself, so I'm talking subsequent to law school, when after I returned to Dallas from New Orleans, I've sort of seen that the education system here has not been responsive to a Latino community and just really hasn't contemplated it. I mean, it's interesting. Steve Murdoch and Texas A&M were coming up with all these demographic studies now for probably a decade. I remember going down to Texas A&M lecturing on the new boom that we were going to see during the 2000 census. But the school district is just now, I think, beginning to react and do things that are a little more innovative to try to contemplate what the student population is going to look like and what the needs of that student population are going to look like. And when a seat came open on the Board of Trustees, I thought that maybe with my skill set I might be able to be helpful to the school district and try to do some things that would make some sense and make a difference. I didn't come in with any grandiose ideas like we were going to change the thing overnight, but I thought I could help move the ball forward, kind of like that the second baseman on your baseball team that hits 270, bats lead off, may steal some bases. You just wanted to be a solid contributor, and that's how I went into it.
What ways, if any, do you identify with the Latinos, specifically like the Mexican Americans that live in this area? I mean, since you came from a little bit different background.
Certainly. I think there are a few unifying characteristics. Certainly, I think language is. Language is probably first and foremost. And secondly, being the son of immigrants, I feel a kinship and a bond with many of the people who live in this community. I saw a statistic the other day that 35% of all people in Dallas either have foreign-born parents or were themselves foreign-born, which I think is a startling statistic. If I think back to my initial reaction in '86 when I came to town, I was like, this is what white America is like, right? I mean, in Miami, you just don't have, I didn't have exposure to it. I think for my personal development, it was absolutely crucial for me to come to Dallas and be at SMU. I think it was so, so important. Just like my experience in going to New Orleans and being around a thriving, politically active African-American community was really, really important for my personal development as a human being. And I forget your question, I'm just kind of rambling, but...
How do you identify with that?
Yeah, so language and the immigrant experience and... I think those are probably the two sort of links that I have with the constituency that I represent. And then thirdly, I guess, would be a desire to pursue education. We are lucky to be in this country where there's a lot of opportunity. You know, my father frequently says in Spain there's no way both his children would have been lawyers. The system was just not set up to create that for him. But here we have a huge opportunity. We just need to, first of all, remove the last remaining obstacles, and second of all, then educate people on how to avail themselves of this opportunity. Because I really do think there's some wonderful, this country offers such wonderful things for people that, you know, I have a passion for, and I think the people in District 7 desire.
Speaking of the District 7, what are the demographics of
your
constituents?
District 7's student population is 91.5% Latino. Well, that was last year's statistic, probably somewhere around 92, 93 this year. 81-82% Latino population. Interestingly, when you discount for non-citizens, the Latino voting impact is substantially diminished, because we do have one of the benefits of having a wonderful economy in North Texas. During the 90s, we attracted a lot of people from all over the United States and all over the world. So in District 7, we have a lot of people that are non-citizens that are contributing to Dallas, and they choose to reside in that area. So we have a third of the 80% Latino population is non-citizen. That may even be conservative.
What would you say are the underpinnings of tension between Mexican-Americans, African-Americans, and the DISD?
It's interesting. I've tried to reflect on this issue a lot, man, and I think this issue manifested itself most starkly during the redistricting process. I perceived it, and again, this is just my perception as a human being, that there was no desire by the African American trustees to share power. Even though the statistics were right there, you know, Latinos represented 40% of the population, you know, 40% of 9 seats does not equal 2. There were only 2 majority-minority Latino seats that could elect a person of their choice. And there were 2 African-American seats with a third plurality seat, meaning that the ethnic and racial composition of that seat was not 50% or above. So it's a plurality, but it was like a 42-43% African-American majority seat. There was a map out there that I offered early on that would have created the opportunity for 3 Latinos, 3 African-Americans, and 3 Anglos. And it was rejected out of hand by the African-American trustees. It was early on in the process. And I was so hurt by that. I was so, I felt so defrauded, because one of the African-American trustees actually sat with me and drew the map. And then he turned around and didn't vote for it. That the realization dawned on me that for these trustees, justice was just us. And justice was not something that everyone deserved. And that was extremely, it was a hard lesson to learn, and it was a disappointing lesson to learn.
I think in this area that African Americans and Latinos put themselves against each other?
I think at DISD there's been evidence of that. And I think folks try to think of it about trying to, they think about it as a zero-sum game, about divvying up a small piece of the pie. And my whole point in trying to create 6 minority-majority districts was to grow the pie. Currently, you know, last year I was the only Latino on the school board, you know, before Joe May got elected. So I think there needs to be a lot of work done to really bring the 2 communities together. And it's unfortunate, because when you boil it down, goals are essentially the same, and the ends are exactly the same. But I think there needs to be some leadership that kind of rises above the fray and points people in the right direction. And I'm not sure that's occurred yet. And it's been disappointing. It really, that redistricting, and we went at it for about a year, and we had 2 bites at the apple after the court overturned the first map. And we came up with the same result. And I've never gone through an experience that was that frustrating and disappointing, I'll be honest with you.
Tell me a little bit about what those goals that you share with the African Americans are, as opposed to goals for maybe the whites.
Well, and I say, I'm not sure that the goals are essentially at the end of the day different. I'm talking about DISD, that's 92% African American Latino currently. So I'm just talking exclusively about that institution. Everybody who's involved, African Americans or Latinos, want quality public education for their kids. They want exemplary schools. They want good teachers. They want an administration that's going to be responsive and communicate well with parents. They want access to jobs in DISD, equitable and proportional access to jobs. They want access to contracts from DISD. We have a $1 billion budget, okay? They want to be able to compete fairly for the public sector contracts that come out of DISD. Both communities want that. And I perceive that there's been sort of a competitive, and despite those ends, I think what we've seen are just a lot of sort of racial power plays that have done nothing to sort of to grow the pie, but rather just trying to either hold on to or capture more political power. And in retrospect, and I'm sitting in on a civil rights class right now that my wife is taking, and I understand from the African American community's perspective, anything that's perceived as a net loss is, I think, really, really damaging, because African American community has busted their butts, they've organized, they've suffered, they've worked very, very hard to get where they are, and the African American community doesn't think that, hey, you know, just because our numbers are going down, we should be satisfied with where we are. I mean, there's still more work to be done. And any time that there's a perceived step back or a move back, whether it's in political representation or anything else, I mean, that's extremely threatening. And I understand that. I sympathize with that. I understand that. So it's, I'd like to say that there are not going to be any easy answers. But I do think there needs to be some leadership exerted.
Well, beyond the Dallas School District, mm-hmm. what do you think the most pressing issue is today with Latinos, Mexican Americans, just in general?
You know, when you poll Latinos, and I've seen I don't know how many polls on this, the number one issue is access to education or access to quality primary education, and then access to secondary education. And it really goes beyond being a Latino issue. Texas now has realized that if they don't get 300,000 more Latinos into college during the next decade, we are facing possible collapse of our entire economy in Texas. If we don't educate the group that is now emerging as what will be the working class, then we are at a competitive disadvantage as a state. Businesses in the state are at a competitive disadvantage because they don't have an effective workforce. So when you ask Latinos, it's always education. And I would say secondarily or maybe third, immigration is certainly an important issue. But education always is substantial points higher than anything else. And maybe that's one of the reasons I didn't run for city council. I mean, people ask me, why didn't you run for city council? I said, I'm not a potholes kind of guy. That's not my interest, you know. I'm interested in teachers and students and people learning and people succeeding through education. And that's really where I think that's where the community's interest is, and that's where my interest lies.
So do you plan on continuing in the school board, or do you have other political aspirations?
I'll answer that in two parts. Do I plan on continuing in the school board? The school board is really tough, and unless you're sort of independently wealthy like Dr. Gutierrez or independently sort of accomplished and in a situation that where your employer will support your service, it's very difficult to serve.
He forgets it, pardon me, twice here.
But it's a severance you got. That was the big deal.
Forgot about that.
I say that. So continuing on the school board past 2004 is going to be, I think, difficult for me. That's when my term is up. And I'll have to think about what I do at that point and whether I continue to serve. In terms of running for anything else, everything in politics is timing, I think. Timing is, I'd say, 60-70% of it all. And, my wife and I want to have a baby. We're trying very hard. We've got one on order, you know. We're hoping the stork arrives in this bad weather. And if that happens, I think my life's going to change, you know, dramatically. That's what everybody tells me, at least. Or at least my wife's life is going to change. No, I'm kidding. She's got a bigger career than me. So that's going to impact my decision to do anything else. And then, you know, it's what, at the end of the day, what the community wants. And if there are people in the community who think I would add value in a different capacity, I'm always happy to listen and see if there's an interest there. But you know, right now, you know, I've got to get my sort of financial house in order, my home life in order, and then at that point I might be selfish and think about continuing, you know, to serve the public. So I don't.
Well, on that note, how did you fund your campaign for DISD?
Raise money. Got to raise money. First campaign, I raised $30,000, spent about $28,000, raised it from the business community. I was a part of Leadership Dallas, which are young leaders that are tapped to go through a chamber-sponsored leadership program. I probably raised about $10,000 from my Leadership Dallas friends and colleagues. You raise from family, you raise from people who are able to give in the community. Pretty much all over the place. Then you have interest groups like unions, teachers unions, administrators unions, some contractors. You know, they'll always sort of pitch in and give money. Who else is in the game who gives money? Real estate council, commercial realtors want good schools so they can sell houses in Dallas. So they're interested in the school system. Residential real estate want that. And commercial real estate are also interested in sort of property value issues and tax issues. So they'll put money in the game. And I was in a unique situation because I had to run 1 year, and then the following year I had to run again because of redistricting. After redistricting, all 9 trustees had to run for office. So the following year I raised and spent 20, roughly.
Is that average?
That's high. My first race, I was in with 5 candidates. There were 3 Latinos and 2 Anglos. And I wanted to win that thing without a runoff. I said, if I'm going to run for this thing, I'm running to win. And I think that's the only way you can look at it. So I went great guns to raise a lot of money, and I won without a runoff. I got over 50% so that there was no runoff. 50.52%. And then last year I had one opponent, one of the same guys who ran against me last time, and I won with 82%. So
so how much have your time in campaign do you think you spent raising money? I mean, does it take a lot of, like in Senate and Congress, they generally spend a lot of time?
Yeah, I mean, they raise gajillions of dollars. I mean, every time you get a call from Martin Frost's office, I mean, I always grab my wallet because I know they're going to ask me for money. In my case, I hate asking for money. I don't like doing it at all, especially from friends. So that's very, very difficult for me to do. What I did is I tried to set up campaign co-chairs that went out and raised the money for me and said, you know, my friend's running for office. You know, I think highly of him. But raising money is probably the most distasteful thing that I think you have to do in politics, but it's necessary. If you're gonna run to win, you have to raise money. You've got to do it. I didn't spend a ton of time on it, to be honest with you. I spent more time. I let my campaign co-chairs raise money for me, and I went out and I was the candidate. Just shared ideas and experiences.
Regarding that election that you mentioned with the 5 other individuals,
yes,
there seems to have been a little bit of controversy with some of your opponents saying that you were not their type of Hispanic. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah. I ran, there was a, Ramiro Lopez was active in LULAC. He's lived in Oak Cliff for a long, long time. He had been on DISD, certain DISD committees. I think he's a real sharp guy. He has a good personal story. And I think he saw me as a guy who just sort of showed up and was interested one day in running for office. Think about it, downtown, corporate lawyer, grew up in Miami, maybe Cuban, we don't know about that yet. you know, endorsed by the black mayor, and by potentially downtown business interests, there was, I think, initially a level of suspicion of, you know, kind of who I was. You know, what is this guy all about? Why is Ron Kirk endorsing this guy? What is Ron doing getting involved in our election down here in District 7? I'd lived in Oak Cliff for 6 years. I'd been active in the Mexican Cultural Center and Sev Child Development Center. We helped found that, and you know, our law firm represented the Oak Cliff Foundation and the Oak Cliff Chamber. But I hadn't come up through any of the organizations like LULAC or any of the other grassroots organizations, and didn't have ties into existing political infrastructures that exist in that area. So I was kind of, I think, perceived as an outsider, and there were a lot of questions. And until people got to know me and understand my service on the board, then you heard people say things like, well, he's not the right kind of Hispanic, or not the right kind of Latino. And you hear that in the African-American community too. Well, he's not black enough, or he's an Oreo, or, you know, coconut. I think that kind of name calling is really short-sighted, and I think done many times out of ignorance, and not an ignorance like I'm saying someone's dumb, ignorance of not knowing the person that you're calling that name, I mean, fully. And I think that's where that came from. I don't hear it very much anymore. It didn't last very long.
Would you say that rift that was there in the Latino community has healed somewhat since they've got to know you?
Well, I'm not sure it was a rift, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, I was endorsed by the two former Latino trustees from that area. I think any rift that existed in the Latino community probably existed before I came along. And, you know, different sort of political leaders in the community, I think, were dealing with their relationships before I even came along. And I'm not sure my coming along created a rift by any means. And I just kind of, you know, came in and got to work. And when people said, okay, well, this guy's not, you know, not the devil, I mean, I think everybody started to get a little bit more comfortable. And, you know, and admittedly, I busted my ass and I worked hard. And I went to those very same people who had doubts about me. And I wanted them to touch me and to feel me and say, okay, and to understand my story and to know what I thought and what I felt and where my heart was. And, you know, so I really worked very, very hard to reach out. Now, there's some people that you try to reach out to and they'll never, you know, they'll always conveniently want you to be there as a foil for them, and they won't want to reach out. But I'd say by and large, I feel like I have a broad network of relationships now in the Latino community.
What are some of those internal conflicts within the Hispanic or Latino community?
You know, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. I'll tell you why. Because, you know, when Anglos have a disagreement, nobody ever says, well, hey, the white folks, you know, are disagreeing amongst themselves.
Do you think more, though, because...
I just think, you know, I think you have sometimes different philosophies. Many times it's different personalities. Many times people have egos and they get jealous with each other. I don't think there's necessarily two points. One, I'm not sure that there is one cohesive thing that you can call the Latino community. That's for starters. Secondly, I would suggest that any political rifts that are created, I think can be boiled down to possibly philosophies, and secondly, personalities. But I don't want to spend a lot of time harping on it because, you know, we are human beings and we are going to disagree about things.
Let me clarify what I was trying to get at a little bit more. As a minority group, and maybe not so much in the Dallas School District, since it's such a large population, but as a minority group, they have special issues. Generally, it would be thought of, and myself, I'm not, you know, I'm more of an outsider to that community. And from my point of view, it would seem like they would want to work together to heal some of those goals, to pursue some of those goals. What I was trying to ask is maybe with all the different nationalities, the backgrounds, like Mexican, mm-hmm. you know, you saw when you were growing up Cuban, I mean, there's Honduras, there's, you know, all those different communities, you know, coming together as one, maybe what are some of those conflicting ideologies and how can they heal those to work together to pursue some of the common goals?
You know, I don't know. That's such a complex question. Do we have enough tape?
Yes, we do. We don't have enough time.
Yeah, I mean that's a really big question. I want people just to come away understanding that I'm not sure that the Latino community is a homogenous community. First of all, in certain areas, and I'll give you a great example. Even among Mexicanos and Mexicano-Americanos, there's a rift. I get calls from parents now at certain schools that say, immigrant parents who say, you know, the Mexicano-Americanos treat us terrible. You know, they treat us like dogs. They think that because they've been here for a long time that we're not worth anything. And, you know, so I think sometimes it's human nature to try to create differences with others. And, you know, when you talk about the Latino community, I think it's a lot less homogenous than people think. That's my best way of answering that question, because it's very complex.
You mentioned that that a parent can call you. Are you that approachable to your constituents? I mean, they don't have a problem?
I get calls from a lot of parents. In fact, on the way over here, I got called by a parent in Arcadia Park. This morning at a 7:30 breakfast with two parents who want to talk to me about block scheduling. I get calls about undercooked pizza. I speak at sixth grade graduations when there's no such thing. You know, I try to be extremely accessible because, you know, at the end of the day, I think many times people just want people to listen. And sometimes I can be helpful and sometimes I can't. Sometimes the best thing I can do is say, okay, I can't help you on this issue. This is really an administrative issue. Let me put you in contact with someone that can help you. That's why we have an entire administration to deal with a lot of these issues. But, you know, my rule is I try to call people back within 24 or 48 hours, if not sooner. And, you know, I listen. I try to listen. So, yeah.
Do you think that's part of being part of what leadership is? Is being accessible to people?
Or? Yeah, and I think that's a component. I think that's a good observation. That's a component of it, being accessible and listening, being
what else
available.
What do you think contributes to leadership?
I think sometimes you have to take tough positions that are damaging to you personally. I think leadership is engaging in self-sacrifice to help others, to truly and sincerely believing that what you're doing is helping other people. I think leadership is, there's a component of leadership that involves communicating with people. I think that's something that's helped me in my capacity as a trustee. Up until last year, I was really the only trustee that could communicate with parents. All due respect to Kathleen Leos, but comfortably in Spanish. And I would get a lot of calls from all over. When you're the only, you know, Latino on the school board, you get calls from North Dallas, East Dallas, Seagoville, because people want to be able to talk to you comfortably about their needs in their native language. So I think there were being able to communicate with people is very, very important.
Do you identify yourself as a Latino leader, or how more do you identify yourself?
You know, I don't know that I've had enough time to engage in that type of self-study. I try to lead, but I don't know if I'm necessarily a Latino leader. I think in some respects that might be even limited, because I represent, while I'm elected out of District 7, which is 80% Latino, I represent also the 30% of our students that are African American, and I want to see them succeed, and I want them to have excellent and exemplary schools, and have wonderful academic achievement and great opportunities. I also represent the, you know, 2% Asian and the 7% Anglos that we have in our schools. I think sometimes, you know, the community that elects you will sort of define you, and that's okay. But just saying that I'm a Latino leader, I think, is in some ways limiting.
Along the same vein, who would you say is the most effective Mexican-American leader today?
It's a tough question. You know, I don't know that we've got a really deep bench in terms of our older leadership. I really do think that it's completely wide open. And I like to think that our generation has a lot of opportunity in this area. I think you've got a lot of young people who are able to get educated thanks to the work of Dr. Gutierrez and other in prior generations who opened up opportunities. They've gotten a ton of education. They've got a wonderful skill set, are extremely dynamic, and can really start knocking the ball out of the park. And I think that it's yet to come. I mean, I see guys sort of on the, I'm still a big fan of Henry Cisneros. I'll never forget when he came to speak at SMU when I was there in the late 80s. It was a huge inspiration for me. I campaigned hard for Tony Sanchez. I thought Tony was a really wonderful candidate, and he had a great story that was really relevant. And I still think those two guys are probably in Texas, you know, perceived as probably the most significant Latino leaders. You've got Bill Richardson in New Mexico is the only Latino governor currently. I think that's right, Dr. Gutierrez.
That's correct.
You know, and I admire him as well. He's an extremely prepared guy. He's ready to go. I'd have to say that's kind of the universe of big hitters right now.
You seem to associate yourself a lot with the Democratic Party. Are there any particular reason?
You know, that's interesting because the other thing that some of my opponents tried to pin on me is that I was a Republican too. I was a Cuban Republican endorsed by the black mayor from Miami and a corporate downtown lawyer puppet of the business interests, which is I think probably the worst thing anybody could be characterized as. Anything else? Chaquetero and Vendido was the other one, you know.
Sellout. Change your name.
Yeah. I mean, but no, I've traditionally voted Democrat. I will tell you that in general elections, I carefully choose candidates on both sides of the aisle, and even during this last election, I helped Republicans and Democrats. I think in Dallas especially, that makes a lot of sense to do that. For some reason, the policy decisions that Democrats take are, I think, a little more congruent with where I am as an individual. Again, I see the support that Democrats have traditionally given to public education, to higher education. You see the huge cuts that the Republican control of the legislature and governor are now proposing with respect to higher ed, with it taking among the biggest hits in the entire budget. You see health care for the poor. We have a ridiculous amount of children without health care here in Texas, and that to me is sort of a basic right, something that the government needs to step up to the plate and furnish, and it does so woefully inadequately. I feel substantially more congruent. Maybe I'm also kind of a contrarian, so and root for the underdog, and I think typically I do think Democrats generally sort of have more accessibility to persons that might be the underdog. I don't know how cutting taxes on the rich helps, you know, the common person, and that continues to baffle me. I think Democrats can also have been leaders on landmark legislation throughout U.S. history. They were leaders on civil rights. They were leaders on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and social programs. And I think that's a valuable function of government. I mean, I take issue with libertarians and say, you know, government should be, you know, should only sort of protect one's personal property and completely stay out, you know, of my life otherwise. I really do think that the government should play an active role in shaping what the community is going to look like, and many times can be a progressive catalyst for doing that.
Are you a member of any Latino or Mexican American organizations?
Yeah, I sit on the national board of the National Association of Latino Elected Officials. NALEO is what it's called. I'm one of a new board member. I'm on the Latino Advisory Board of KERA, our public TV and radio stations that I think are fabulous. I support wholeheartedly. I'm on the Latino Advisory Committee of Comerica Bank, Texas. I think I'm a member of LULAC. I think I paid my check or something like that. I think I'm a member of the Chamber. It seems like every time they send you a check, they send you another bill. I send them a check and they send me another bill. So I don't know who I'm a member. I'm a member of the Mexican American Bar Association, now the Hispanic Bar Association. So yeah, a couple.
Which organizations do you think are most effective today, and how so?
That's tough. I don't know. In terms of effectiveness.
Does anyone stick out in your mind as maybe more prominent?
You know, I like NALEO. I think NALEO does a really, really good job. They put on a spectacular candidates training here in Dallas probably a year ago that I helped organize that I think was valuable for existing elected officials and anybody interested in. And we had a UTA student actually who attended that candidates training. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he may have run for council later. I think, and I went to their training at Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. as well. I think they do a real high quality work where they bring in really the leaders in the field to let people know what the issues of the day are and let people know practical strategies for how to run and win and develop a message that resonates and crosses over.
Do you think there's anything that any of these organizations could do to be more effective, maybe?
You know, I really haven't given that a lot of thought. And one of the tough parts about being on the school board is you are completely bombarded by so many things, and you're so engaged in just trying to improve the school district. Some of these bigger issues, I find I have less time to just sort of philosophically ruminate over. Sometimes I feel overwhelmed.
Did you get any kind of campaign support or endorsements from any specific organization?
No, and I'm not sure that many endorse. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't think LULAC endorses. I don't think PURE, People United for Redistricting and Equality, endorses. I'm trying to think. You know, Tejano Democrats and Mexican American Democrats do endorse. And during my first election, and I can't ever remember which is which, but I was endorsed by one of them. And I just can't remember which one. Yes, sir.
Okay, going back to your stance on the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. and also the fact that you're a member of the DISD, I want to know what you think the DISD has done to help its students as, you know, part of government and everything, help students, constituents, what they have been the highlights of the past, you know, since you've been in term.
Okay, that good question. We've been able to give teachers 2-4% pay increases consecutively without raising taxes. We cut about 100 administrative positions down at DISD. I think those are the two important highlights, because I think the reality was we were fat down in our administrative ranks at Ross Avenue, and we were able to make some big strides in getting a little leaner there. Teachers needed the pay increase. This last year, we went into the year with DISD starting teachers having the highest salary in the entire Metroplex, which is really, really exciting. In fact, this is the first year in probably 2 decades that we started with no teacher vacancies. When I first got on the board, we had 2,000 teacher vacancies. Just to put that in perspective, and we've got about 11,000 teachers total in our ranks. So we had permanent subs in a lot of our classes. Now, you know, I'm not saying that that's all me or all Dr. Moses. The economy has something to do with it. We've been able to cherry pick a lot of professionals and put them through alternative certification programs and get them into our teacher ranks, engineers from TI, Alcatel, Nortel, and we've benefited from a down economy to fill our ranks. But I think that's been significant. We had the highest number of exemplary schools and recognized schools in Dallas history this last year. I was very, very proud to see that most of our African American majority high schools were all recognized. Kimball, Lincoln, Carter, Amacio Smith, I believe Roosevelt, they were all recognized. And that I thought was a huge and important step and accomplishment for the district. We have continued to support programs like Avance and HIPPI that I feel very strongly about. And these are programs that allow the school district to go out into the community and teach parents how to be more involved in the educational lives of their children so as to improve parent involvement. I think that's a huge step and something that, that the district needs to continue to do. We launched another program called BIKE this year. We've got parent academies going on this year. We've started a program called Llaves del Éxito, which is designed to teach parents sort of the vagaries of how to get their kids into college, especially parents who have never, who themselves did not go to college. It's a very important thing. I'm heartened by our administration's attempt and my suggestion to go and recruit teachers in Mexico. We have a serious deficiency of bilingual teachers at the ISD. Again, the institution is still trying to catch up with our clients, our student population, and their needs. But I think we're making headway there. We're not where we need to be. And I just think generally there's been, I'll tell you another thing that I felt really happy about, and I think it was an important psychological step for Dallas, is that we got 78% passage of our $1.4 billion bond package. This is the largest bond package in Texas history, and it passed 78% in Dallas. And that was, I can't tell you what important psychological step it was for the community to say, we're going to reinvest in the kids, we're going to reinvest in schools. We think a lot of the basura, a lot of the trash that we had between superintendents and trustees may be behind us, at least behind us enough to move forward and reinvest in the ISD. I think that was extremely important. I still think we have a lack of confidence with the community and something that, that we need to continue to work on every day to improve, but I would submit to you that since 2001, we're in the news a heck of a lot less about negative things and a heck of a lot more about positive things. I think people could probably, just on the media coverage alone, sense a difference in the district.
Okay, and on the other hand, besides the lack of confidence and the redistricting issues you had, what are some of the negative points?
Dropout rate continues to be, you know, alarming, especially in the Latino community, and not just Latino community, the African American community too. We just ran some statistics and discovered that completion rates for African Americans are only about 60%, and just in line essentially with Latino population. That's that's a huge concern. We last year we invited the National Center for Dropout Prevention to come in out of Clemson and do an audit of our entire district. And they told us that we spent too much time, or a disproportionate amount of money, in trying to recover kids and in high school and to prevent high school dropouts when we need, and we need to be doing more at the elementary and junior high school level. That was a major point of emphasis that they have. So we're trying to roll some more programs out now. We just started a mentoring program. I guess it's about a year and a half old, where we're trying to take at-risk ninth graders, meaning that they become credit deficient. They've started to flunk from ninth to 10th, and that's where we lose most of them. And we're pairing them up with mentors and professionals one-on-one. And it's called the Take One, Save One. And we're continuing to try to recruit and get people involved in that program. I will say there's more of an interest from the students than there has been from the actual mentors. It's tough. It's tough to get mentors. And the first year it was what I termed deficient. This year it's improved, but it's not where it needs to be. It's one of our big initiatives on it.
Get away from DISD. I see that in your resume you had a lot of background with NAFTA. I was wondering if you could give us some information on that and what your stance on NAFTA is.
Yeah, my first job out of law school, I worked for a guy, former Secretary of State named David Dean, who's Secretary of State under Clements. He was the head of the public policy section of a firm called Winstead. And he was the NAFTA initiatives chairman for Dallas, for the Dallas Chamber. And because I was working for this guy in that department at the law firm, I got exposed to a lot of NAFTA's related activities. We worked hard to lobby for passage of NAFTA and then worked on various projects related to implementation, including improving I-35 as a transportation corridor so we wouldn't have this bottleneck of trucks that would impede international trade and damage or increase congestion in local communities like Dallas. And that was an interesting project I devoted about 3 years of my career to. And we would lobby in Washington and Austin and Oklahoma City and Kansas to try to get these states together and get money from the federal government. And we did. We were successful in getting added funds. Getting added funds for the roadway. And then I taught an AFTA course at Texas Tech Law School and at UTD for 6 years, a graduate level AFTA course. It was that experience.
Can you tell us just? Not related to that at all. Just a little bit about your wife and her family background.
My wife's a really interesting cat. She's born and raised in a small farming and ranching community in South Texas called Hebbardville. It's about 5,000 people near Laredo. Her father was a county judge there for a long time and active in Democratic politics. He's an older gentleman. She's the youngest of six. And in fact, her next eldest sibling is 13 years older than her. So she was, I think, first believed to be a tumor before she was born, and then she grew up in politics herself, helping her father, and he had two unsuccessful races for state representative, was elected as county clerk, tax assessor, collector, and then
who was her father?
Horacio Ramirez.
And what was your wife's name?
Marisa Yvette Ramirez, So she was involved. She worked on Henry Bustamante's staff for a while. She worked for Frank Tejeda, just always had an interest. Her father was a contemporary of Henry B. Gonzalez and Kika de la Garza. He's at sort of that age level, and is a really, really interesting guy, a really impressive guy. And to this day, I still call him Judge. He will always be Judge Ramirez to me. It's a great story about when I proposed to Marisa. We had actually gone down to Hebronville, and this is 4 months in advance of when I was going to ask her. I decided to do it the old-fashioned way. And the judge and I were sitting in the foyer, in the family room, watching This Week with David Brinkley. And if you know anything about the judge, you know he does not like to be interrupted when he's watching his political shows on Sunday. So we're sitting there, and I'm extremely quiet. And I turn to him, I think, okay, there's a commercial. It's probably the right time. And I say, Judge, you know, Marisa and I have now been dating for 3 years, and you know, I love her very much, and I love the family very much, and I wanted to do this the right way, so I wanted to come to you and ask you for her hand in marriage. And the judge, a man with very, very few words, takes the remote and begrudgingly lowers the volume on the remote, turns to me and says, good. It's about time. Let us know if there's anything we can do. And he put the volume back on Cokie Roberts and David Brinkley, and that was it. And then I asked Marisa to marry me just a few months later, and she said yes. So that's one of my favorite stories about the judge. A very serious man, a few words, but a really impressive guy. She now, Marisa, works with the United States Chamber of Commerce, and she is the executive director of the Southwest region for the U.S. Chamber, and works with local and state chambers of commerce on business issues. So,
does your wife have any political aspirations?
No. She's still trying to convince me that she hates politics, but she likes her job.
Talk about your program on leadership a little bit, like the curriculum, participants.
One of the things that I noticed, I failed to mention, I used to coach the mock trial team for 6 years at Sunset High School. That's kind of how I really got involved with the public schools. And I got our firm to adopt Sunset, so we started running a leadership program there as well. And we expanded the program to include Adamson High School. If you know anything about Adamson and Sunset, 95% Latino student population at each school. And they're really kind of forgotten neighborhood schools. They lose a lot of their best students to the magnet schools, you know. And I think that demoralizes their campus a little bit. Great kids that are at each school, and I thought a leadership program would make a lot of sense. So I partnered with a civics professor at Adamson and a professor at Sunset, and we started the Southern Dallas Leadership Forum, which was initially an 8-month leadership program modeled after Leadership Dallas that I was a graduate of, where we kind of took them through different modules on community organization, conflict, management, diversity, history, and it was a pretty successful program. We had about 35 graduates from the program. All of them, save one, went on to college, which was really exciting. That was another module we did, pre-college planning. And they all went on to 2 or 4 year universities, and I'm really, really proud of them. The one who didn't went to the Marines. so he will likely end up going to school as well. But I got a bunch of young professionals and college students to help mentor the high school students as well. So it just wasn't the high school students sitting in a class. They were surrounded by young professionals that would help debrief with them and challenge them on ideas and seek their input and involvement.
Would you please tell us your views on the lack of programs for limited English speaking students and also your views on bilingual education?
Both good questions. As everyone may know here, DISD has the largest LEP population, limited English proficient, of any school district in the entire state of Texas. It may come as a surprise to some of you, thinking, hey, San Antonio would have more LEP kids, or maybe Houston, but it's actually DISD. We've got about 53,000 LEP students. Currently, we have a very limited program for kids who are LEP. We don't have bilingual programs at all grades, and we try to concentrate our efforts on the earlier grades. So for kids who come over and they're limited English proficient in high school, we actually offer them, I think, a really poor suite of services. Something that I want to continue to improve. My mom's a bilingual education teacher, and I'm extremely favorable. I mean, Dade County, Florida was one of the incubators for bilingual education. I think one of the places that does a good job of it in the United States. In fact, when my mom, who's been doing it for 23 years now, goes to conferences, national conferences on bilingual education, and she has commented to me that here in Texas we actually are pretty far behind in our commitment to bilingual education. And she feels that Dade County in Florida does a much better job of it, and that may be a byproduct of the power structure in being more Latino dominant in Miami-Dade, and maybe there's just more political will to do it. But I don't perceive that there's, for my colleagues on the board, that there's a huge and overwhelming political will to tackle that problem. I just,
In what way do you think Dade County does a better job of bilingual education?
They have more bilingual teachers. Their bilingual teachers are better prepared, a more rigorous preparation. Potentially their curricula, and she hasn't specifically said this, but it's possible that the curricula is better suited for bilingual students.
Okay, what are you doing to get Latino contractors to get more bond issues?
Latino contractors and bond issues. Currently, I think, let me back up. First thing we did is we established higher goals for minority participation across the board on all our contracts. In the 92 bond package, it was 20% and 25%, depending on what category, for contracts. We raised that to 30 and 35% for minority participation goals. We have done a number of outreach activities with Hispanic contractors, organizations, and other groups to get companies certified. Typically, you have to be certified first as a minority contractor, and then ready to participate with the district. Because participating with the district's hard. I mean, it's a very difficult and confusing process. And for people who have never done it before, it's extremely difficult to get sort of plugged in to the program. So we're doing, I think, a lot more outreach. We're devoting a lot more resources to getting more Latino-owned companies to participate. In fact, if you look at our program managers, which have been the only contracts that we've let, we've got all of them have substantial Latino participation. 5 minutes. All right.
Okay.
That was a good question.
I've got several more questions.
Yeah,
several. All right.
One more question. Is Joan White going to be able to open your redistricting again?
I don't know. That's a good question. We ran into that issue recently, and I'm trying to think how it went down. Joe wanted to swap out two districts with Ron Price and make his district more Latino friendly and Ron's more friendly for Ron. And I don't think anybody was necessarily opposed to that. It's not like Joe wants to reopen the whole process. I'd be willing to reopen the whole process, but Joe, that's not Joe's goal. He wants to swap out two precincts with Ron to make their districts better for them or for others who may come behind them. There was a question as to whether DISD could redistrict on its own and whether we had the statutory authority to do it. We are not governed by the education code, exclusively by the education code, like most districts. We have a special session law that just affects DISD. So in this special session law, we are not granted the authority to redistrict more than once every 10 years. We didn't like the opinion that we got from council, so we got Rolando Rios to give us another opinion on whether we could redistrict, and he said he thought we could, but under the education code. And his opinion, admittedly, for me as a lawyer, was a little bit confusing. So it's an open question, and Rios admitted that there was no authority to really guide us on this. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to the Attorney General and get an Attorney General's opinion whether DISD itself, under its special session law, can redistrict. If it does redistrict, or if we do swap out these precincts, does it constitute redistricting? My opinion is yes, because you can't just redistrict a little without it being redistricting. It's like being just a little bit pregnant. No, you're pregnant, okay? You're just not a little pregnant. You just can't redistrict a little bit without it being redistricting. I think if we do go ahead and redistrict, or swap out these precincts, it is redistricting. The final question is, if it is redistricting, our special session law says that all nine trustees need to run again. And I don't think there's a huge appetite on the board for all 19 trustees running. I've run two elections in 2 years, and I'm really not excited about running a third in a third year. So
how long is your term?
It should be 3 years. But when you have redistricting, it abbreviated my first term, right? Because after redistricting, all nine of us ran again. So I essentially had my first term was a 1 year. My second term, then we had to restagger all the terms so that only three trustees run at the same time. We pulled out of a hat terms, and I got a 2 year term. So I'm up in May of 2004.
Several more here. Do we have just
a couple of more minutes, or you can ask the people that wanted to ask the question if you can?
Yeah, read. What time we have?
Okay.
A few more minutes.
We're good.
I have somebody want to know if you feel that competition among schools would increase secondary education, or what do you?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Somebody want to ask that?
Well, a couple of years ago, I know vouchers were up in the air, and I just wanted to know what your
position
was. Philosophy was about school vouchers.
Yeah, I don't see vouchers as a solution, and I'll be honest with you. We educate currently, if you aggregate the number of kids that are in private school or homeschooled, maybe in a parochial private school in Texas, that's about 250,000 students. Guess how many we educate in our public schools? 4.1 million. Okay. To me, an answer to improving public schools is not giving money to private schools, giving state money to private schools. It doesn't fix the problem. I just can't see philosophically how it fixes the problem. People will try to tell you that, well, if you give a kid a voucher and you tell them they can take $6,000 and go anywhere in the marketplace and spend that money, that the competition will raise the bar or make other schools more competitive. But there's a flaw in that. I mean, some sort of, that's kind of a Jack Kemp free market argument. But what they don't tell you is that there's not a free market here. If you told an immigrant parent, you give them $6,000 and they can go to Southlake ISD or Highland Park ISD, well, now you're maybe, now you're talking. But Highland Park and Southlake don't want that. I mean, they want to keep their demographics just the way they are, because they succeed very well that way. So you're really not, there's not a true market out there. Plus that $6,000, the fallacy is that, that $6,000 is going to get you into Green Hill or into Hockaday or into St. Mark's. That doesn't pay a third of some of those schools. So I mean, I just can't see how taking money away from public schools that are already strapped for money, we have a entire public school finance crisis on our hands, where it's a train wreck waiting to happen. It will happen. It's not going to get resolved in this legislature. I don't see how vouchers, at best, they're a small band-aid on a huge gash. Yes, ma'am.
How
My name is Camille White.
We've met before, Camille.
Yes, we have. And I have two questions. The first question is, you mentioned that some of the things that you did was that you guys cut 100 administrative positions.
That's right.
In reality, those positions were never filled. They were just on the budget to be filled. So in reality, did you really cut 100 jobs?
Yeah, because we eliminated the jobs. They will not be filled.
And my next question is also, Dr. Moses, when he was in Austin, he helped to design this new test that we have. And I guess he didn't think he was going to have to sit under the authority of it. So now that he is, he went campaigning saying that he doesn't want the kids to take the test. How do you feel about it? Do you think they should take the test?
Let me clarify one thing. When he was Commissioner of Education, he argued for phasing out the TOS and going to the tax. He actually did not design the test when he was Commissioner. Now, what has happened is the State Board of Education has come up with an extremely difficult test and a passing standard that is, in my opinion, extremely punitive. So what Dr. Moses and the Board of Trustees agrees with him on this, we passed a resolution saying that the State Board really should revisit kind of where they are on their passing standard and the difficulty of the test. And just to let you know, I took the exit level math, and there's advanced geometry on there. There's trig on there. We don't even teach trig. There is substantial algebra, advanced algebra on there. And I, as a lawyer, and I'm a little more educated than the average bird, probably would have failed that.
So you're saying you don't feel we should administer the test?
I think we need to revisit the passing standard on the test. Because
I think that the standard should be raised because of the fact that you just threw out these numbers at us saying that we have a huge number of students that are not making it into college, and also the statistics also state that when DISD students graduate, they're not prepared for college, so they're having to take these remedial classes to even get up to par. So I don't understand you guys' concept of saying we don't need to raise the bar, because he was the one who was really preaching raise the standards, raise the bar.
You know, I don't think anybody disagrees with raise the bar. It's how much you raise it. I could give you a test, and Dr. Gutierrez could give you a test on this class that he knows you would fail. Somebody could give me a test on being a lawyer that they knew I would fail. Somebody could give Mike Moses a test on being Commissioner of Education that he would fail. Okay? I think the tax test has been made intentionally too difficult, and the passing standard has been made intentionally too high. And this is my theory only, because at the end of the day, pro-voucher forces lobbied very hard at the State Board of Education to get it this high so that the headlines read during the next 2 years that public schools are failing across the board, and then they can get vouchers. My theory and my theory only, but when they did the initial tests, the initial sort of sample tests, the students that are currently in the system scored no better in chance, meaning no better than me going on the list and doing A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So there is no correlation between the test that they're currently taking and the new tax test. There is no TOS equivalency, in other words. So we know, we argued for a TOS equivalency so that when the kids take it next year, say, okay, this is how they did on this test, but how does that correlate to TOS, and was there an increase? Because what we want to show is continued improvement, there's no doubt. And I think everybody's arguing for higher standards, but you know, I can give you a test that you'll fail and that you'll look really bad on. And depending on my motives, I may want to do that. And I think that's, we're seeing a little bit of that at the state level right now, and I'm hopeful they'll revisit their decision.
I have a question.
Yes.
My name is Pam Bass.
Hi, Pam.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you, thanks for having me.
Hurry.
Do you get a salary for this?
No. This is purely volunteer. Trustees don't get paid anything. We get a couple perks, which are, I get a dinosaur version Palm Pilot. This is, I think, the first one that they ever made. You know, it doesn't have any fancy pictures or anything. And I get a cell phone so people can get in touch with me. Those are the only two perks that we get as trustees. It's purely voluntary.
Do you get trips paid for by the...
Yeah, we get
to go and check out things in other parts of the country.
Sometimes we go visit other school districts. We go to continuing education programs. We go to... the National School Boards Association annual meeting where all the school board members, it's typically paid for by the district.
What is the name of the superintendent? Dallas Independent School District, and how much does he make?
Mike Moses, he makes $310,000. And let me tell you,
one more quick question.
I think he's a bargain at that price. I think he's a bargain.
Quick.
I read in the paper about that going south of the border
for teachers.
Candidates. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to hear that number one, simply because of the economy as it is right now, I'm surprised that you are not getting viable candidates here locally who are bilingual. Is it because the standards, the requirements, something is just too rigid? And how is that going to affect those that are coming from over there to meet those standards?
2 points. First, we are getting very good candidates, but not in the numbers that we need to meet the demand. I mean, the numbers are literally overwhelming us. I saw a statistic, and I can't tell you the number, but our secondary schools are only putting out X number of bilingual educators every year.
And we need
X plus 50. So that's why we need to supplement our needs with candidates from Mexico.
I find it difficult to apply to those types of things simply because...
I'd encourage you to. You grab my card. I'll put you in contact with our HR.
Well, is there anything else you wanted to close with before we wrap this up?
No, I think we're out of time, but I'm thankful. I think everybody had really good questions. Thank you.